Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we explore new evidence on managing asymptomatic carotid stenosis, restoring vision in advanced macular degeneration, and preventing migraine in children. We discuss innovative cellular therapy for autoimmune disease, review sudden cardiac arrest in athletes, and describe a case of severe systemic infection with vision loss. Perspectives examine global tobacco risks, the future of telehealth payment, Medicare coverage of new technologies, and the things physicians carry. Medical management and revascularization for asymptomatic carotid stenosis by Thomas Brott from the Mayo Clinic, Jacksonville, Florida, and co-authors. The management of carotid artery stenosis that has not caused recent symptoms, asymptomatic carotid stenosis, has been controversial. Improvements in medical therapy, carotid artery stenting, and carotid endarterectomy have called into question the preferred management of asymptomatic carotid stenosis. These studies evaluated whether adding revascularization to intensive medical management would provide greater benefit than intensive medical management alone. Two parallel trials enrolled 2,495 patients with high-grade, at least 70%, asymptomatic carotid stenosis across 155 centers in 5 countries. The stenting trial compared intensive medical management alone with carotid artery stenting plus intensive medical management. The endarterectomy trial compared intensive medical management alone with carotid endarterectomy plus intensive medical management. The primary outcome was a composite of any stroke or death assessed from randomization to 44 days, or ipsilateral ischemic stroke assessed during the remaining follow-up period up to 4 years. Among patients with high-grade stenosis without recent symptoms, the addition of stenting led to a lower risk of a composite of perioperative stroke or death or ipsilateral stroke within 4 years than intensive medical management alone. Carotid endarterectomy did not lead to a significant benefit. Do the results of the trial by Brott and co-authors mean that stenting should be widely adopted for asymptomatic stenosis? In an editorial, Martin Brown from the University College London and Leo Bonatti from Basel University, Switzerland, write that caution is required. First, the low rate of stroke with stenting reflects careful selection of patients and skilled interventionists, which are not available in all vascular centers. Second, the difference between stenting and medical management was based on a small number of events. Third, medical therapy could be further intensified, as the authors acknowledge. An equally important issue is whether the benefit observed over the 4-year time horizon of the trial justifies the early increase in risk from stenting. These editorialists therefore consider it reasonable to advise patients with asymptomatic carotid stenosis to start intensive medical therapy immediately and to delay revascularization until such time as symptoms develop, which will occur in only a small proportion of patients. Exceptions would then be made for patients who prefer to take the risk of revascularization or who cannot take medical therapy, in which case stenting would be the choice for suitable patients at a center with skilled and experienced interventionists. Subretinal photovoltaic implant to restore vision in geographic atrophy due to AMD by Frank Holtz from the University of Bonn, Germany, and co-authors. Age-related macular degeneration, AMD, is the most common cause of incurable blindness in older adults. Geographic atrophy is an advanced stage of dry, non-exudative AMD that leads to progressive, irreversible death of photoreceptors and retinal pigment epithelial cells, causing profound vision loss. Geographic atrophy affects approximately 5 million persons worldwide. None of the currently approved therapies have led to a meaningful improvement in vision. The photovoltaic retina implant microarray PRIMA system combines a subretinal photovoltaic implant and glasses that project near-infrared light to the implant in order to restore sight to areas of central retinal atrophy. In this clinical study, 38 participants received a PRIMA implant. Among the 32 participants who completed 12 months of follow-up, the PRIMA system led to a clinically meaningful improvement in visual acuity from baseline in 26 participants, 81%. Among the participants, 21 serious adverse events occurred within 2 months after surgery, 95% of which resolved within 2 months after onset. The most common adverse events were elevated intraocular pressure and peripheral retinal breaks treated intraoperatively. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Jacques Duncan from the University of California, San Francisco, writes that the results by Holtz and co-authors show an improvement in visual acuity. When participants used the PRIMA system with the paired glasses, vision improved such that 81% of the participants were able to read at least 10 letters, 2 lines more on a standard chart than they could at the start of the study. What distinguishes the PRIMA system from other prosthetic approaches to vision restoration is the ability to adjust zoom and brightness of images projected to the implant from the camera feed, which enables users to zoom in on visual targets. Using digital enhancements, participants gained more letters and were able to read letters that were smaller than the limit predicted by the distance between the pixels. Participants magnified the images by up to 12 times to read letters. The therapeutic approach described by Holtz and colleagues represents the first treatment to restore vision in persons with advanced geographic atrophy. As with any new treatment, evaluation in larger numbers of patients with longer follow-up is warranted. Fremanezumab in Children and Adolescents with Episodic Migraine by Andrew Hershey from the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Ohio, and co-authors. Migraine is a common neurologic disorder in childhood and adolescence, with an estimated overall prevalence of 11%. Children and adolescents with migraine, as well as their families, face a substantial burden due to their attacks, including lost schooling and work days, poor educational performance, and missed social activities. Fremanezumab, a humanized monoclonal antibody that selectively targets calcitonin gene-related peptide, is approved for the prevention of migraine in adults. Evidence from randomized control trials in children and adolescents is needed. In this study, 234 participants 6 to 17 years of age with a diagnosis of episodic migraine, defined as migraine for at least 6 months and a history of 14 or fewer headache days per month, were randomly assigned to receive monthly subcutaneous injections of fremanezumab or matched placebo for 3 months. Fremanezumab resulted in greater reductions in the number of migraine days and headache days than placebo. Injection site erythema was the most common adverse event with fremanezumab. Longer follow-up is required to further understand the efficacy and safety of the drug in this population. CD19 CAR T-cell therapy for autoimmune hemolytic anemia by Ranan Li from the Institute of Hematology and Blood Diseases Hospital, Tianjin, China, and co-authors. Autoimmune hemolytic anemia, AIHA, a complex disorder mediated by autoantibodies against red cells, leads to the accelerated destruction of red cells and severe anemia. In patients with AIHA, the risk of relapse after therapy is high, owing to persistent autoreactive B-cell activity. Multi-refractory AIHA is a more advanced stage of disease that is defined by a lack of response to at least three lines of therapy. CD19-directed chimeric antigen receptor CAR T-cell therapy results in profound B-cell depletion and may be a useful approach to achieving drug-free remission in multi-refractory AIHA. In this study, CD19 CAR T-cells were administered to 11 patients with primary multi-refractory AIHA, 5 in a compassionate use program and 6 in the phase 1 study. The median follow-up was 12.2 months. CD19 CAR T-cell therapy had expected toxic effects. 67 adverse events occurred during treatment among the 11 patients. All 11 patients had a complete response, discontinued immunosuppressive therapy, and had apparent improvements in quality of life. Additional clinical trials are necessary to confirm these findings and refine treatment strategies. Sudden cardiac arrest in athletes. A review article by Rachel Lampert from Yale School of Medicine, New Haven, Connecticut, and Kimberly Harmon from the University of Washington, Seattle. The incidence of sudden cardiac arrest in athletes varies according to age, race and ethnic group, sex, sport, and social determinants of health. The common causes of sudden cardiac arrest include cardiomyopathies, electrical disorders, coronary artery anomalies, and other cardiac structural abnormalities. There has not been an increase in sudden cardiac arrest in athletes in association with the COVID-19 pandemic. Primary prevention is based on cardiovascular screening before participation in sports, and secondary prevention on implementation of emergency action plans. Diagnostic evaluation of athletes who survive sudden cardiac arrest should mirror that of age-matched non-athletes, with additional sport-specific considerations, and should be performed by medical professionals with expertise in athletic adaptation. An increasing body of evidence indicates that many athletes can return to play after disease-specific treatment without an increase in risk, and professional societies now consider return to participation in sports to be reasonable or appropriate through shared decision-making for numerous cardiac conditions. A 63-year-old man with pulmonary nodules, liver mass, and vision loss, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Marlene Durand and colleagues. A 63-year-old man presented with fever, cough, and sudden vision loss in the right eye following a recent illness that began with vomiting and diarrhea. Imaging revealed multiple cavitary pulmonary nodules, a large hepatic mass with a filling defect in the hepatic vein, and scattered brain lesions suggestive of septic emboli. Ophthalmologic examination confirmed endogenous endophthalmitis with orbital involvement. Despite broad-spectrum antibiotics, the patient deteriorated and required enucleation of the right eye. Cultures from sputum and bronchoalveolar lavage eventually grew Klebsiella pneumoniae, and a string test confirmed a hypermucoviscous phenotype. Molecular testing on the enucleated eye also identified K. pneumoniae. The constellation of liver abscess, septic thrombophlebitis, pulmonary nodules, brain lesions, and endogenous endophthalmitis was consistent with disseminated infection due to hypervirulent Klebsiella pneumoniae, a rare but increasingly recognized syndrome associated with high morbidity, including permanent vision loss, and a propensity for metastatic spread even in previously healthy individuals. Smokeless Tobacco and Oral Cancer in Global Perspective, a perspective by Mark Pariscandala from the National Cancer Institute, Bethesda, Maryland, and co-authors. Smokeless tobacco products are made entirely or partly from tobacco leaves or extract and are consumed orally without being burned. Smokeless tobacco products are used by more than 360 million people in 140 countries. The vast majority of these users, 77%, are in low and middle income countries, especially in Southeast Asia. Smokeless tobacco use is particularly high in Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, and Papua New Guinea. And whereas rates of cigarette smoking have declined in most countries in recent decades, smokeless tobacco use has been increasing. Smokeless tobacco is classified by the International Agency for Research on Cancer as a Group 1 carcinogen in humans. According to data from the Global Cancer Observatory, the incidence of oral cancer, the primary type of cancer linked to smokeless tobacco, has been increasing, particularly in countries with high smokeless tobacco use. Health professionals who have regular contact with patients have many opportunities to talk with and counsel them about tobacco use, including smokeless tobacco. During a simple oral examination, dentists and doctors not only can detect early signs of health effects, such as oral precancerous lesions in patients using smokeless tobacco, but they can also use such an examination as a teachable moment to encourage patients to quit. Further research is needed, but asking about smokeless tobacco use and providing cessation treatment in clinical settings remain critical avenues for addressing smokeless tobacco use and preventing oral cancer. Financing telehealth, moving beyond payment parity. A perspective by Tara Sklar from the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law, Tucson, and Barack Richman from the George Washington University School of Law, Washington, D.C. Telehealth was one of the victims of the budget impasse that shut down the U.S. government on October 1, 2025. Any renewal of regulatory flexibilities facilitating access to telehealth services for Medicare beneficiaries, including waivers of geographic and originating site restrictions, the easing of certain in-person visit requirements, and authorization for audio-only visits, will require additional funding allocations from Congress. The agreement to reopen the government restored Medicare telehealth flexibilities through January 30, 2026. Telehealth advocates have typically endorsed payment parity, that is, reimbursement for telehealth services at the same rate as equivalent in-person services. But this approach often leads to payments that are far higher than costs and fundamentally neglects telehealth's ability to transform and modernize care delivery. Payment parity ignores telehealth's central attraction, since telehealth services typically cost substantially less than in-person services to deliver. The authors argue that telehealth represents a low-cost, scalable mechanism that can inject new sources of competition into the healthcare sector and help break up consolidation and bring down costs. Rather than parity, policies should ensure that Medicare pays for telehealth services at rates that more closely align with their costs, support lower-cost modes of care delivery, and integrate telehealth into broader value-based care models. Automatic Medicare coverage for new medical technologies. Here we go again. A perspective by Kushal Kadakia from the Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. The U.S. Congress is considering bills that would substantially expand Medicare coverage of putatively transformative technologies, medical devices that receive breakthrough designation from the Food and Drug Administration, and multi-cancer early detection tests. This bipartisan legislation reflects a years-long industry-backed effort to expand Medicare coverage for new technologies. But these authors believe the proposed legislation would undermine the authority of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to implement evidence-based coverage policies and wouldn't serve the best interests of Medicare beneficiaries or the general public. With the proposed legislation, Congress seeks to correct a perceived error of omission, the withholding of purportedly innovative devices from patients. But these efforts gloss over clinical uncertainties at the heart of the coverage debate and risk propagating new errors of commission, the widespread use of products in the absence of adequate evidence, which could harm patients and drive wasteful healthcare spending. The FDA often grants breakthrough designation on the basis of preclinical or early clinical testing. Nonetheless, patients frequently assume that breakthrough designations connote greater effectiveness and strength of evidence than standard FDA approvals. The authors warn that wholesale expansion of Medicare coverage for new technologies would come at substantial cost, and suggest that policymakers consider alternative levers to promote innovation and access to new products. The Things We Carry, a perspective by Rory Spiegel from MedStar Washington Hospital, Washington, D.C. A hospital-issued photo ID, a silver Zebra F701 retractable ballpoint pen, a stick of epinephrine tucked into the cargo pocket of his scrub pants, stored there for emergencies, hemodynamic in nature, an 11-blade scalpel nestled next to the epinephrine, kept there for the rare occasion when a cricothyroidotomy is required. A pair of size 11 race car red Chuck Taylors. These are his non-negotiables, the necessities for any shift. But they are not the only things he carries, and certainly not the most burdensome. A 3-year-old girl who was accidentally shot through the chest, an innocent bystander at a mindless drive-by shooting. He has carried her since he was a third-year resident. A young father and surgeon with respiratory failure he cared for during his first year of his critical care fellowship. A 28-year-old woman with the most severe asthma exacerbation he had ever seen. These are not the only patients he carries. There are others he dare not even mention, since they weigh so heavy on his frame. It is unclear to him why he carries some patients with him and leaves others behind. He just knows that with each additional passenger, their burden increases exponentially. He often wonders if one day the load will just be too much to bear. One pair of trauma shears tucked in next to the epistick and the scalpel. One pack of winter mint gum tucked in his back pocket. A pair of navy blue scrub pants. This particular pair is his favorite because it has an extra pocket sewn onto the right thigh. Valuable space for all the things he carries. In our images in clinical medicine, a 20-year-old woman presented with 9 days of pain and decreased vision in the right eye, as well as 2 weeks of a rash and gum swelling. Fever, dyspnea, and hemoptysis developed. Testing for proteinase 3 antineutrophil cytoplasmic antibodies was positive. A diagnosis of granulomatosis with polyangiitis was made. In another image, a 60-year-old man with a 30-pack-year smoking history presented with a 2-year history of a painful rash on his palms and soles. Numerous pustules with erosions, crusting, and surrounding erythema were noted. A diagnosis of primary palmoplantar pustulosis was made. Primary palmoplantar pustulosis is a chronic inflammatory skin condition characterized by sterile pustules and is highly associated with cigarette smoking. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Tell us what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.